You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW campuses are using layoffs and course cuts to offset state budget reductions. We'll find out more.
First, fans of The Moth have lots of opportunities to check it out here in Wisconsin. The radio version of the storytelling project airs Thursday nights at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Milwaukee has held monthly live storytelling events for years now, and Madison joined in with live shows earlier this year.
George Dawes Green founded The Moth in 1997. He's currently in residence at Beloit College holding the Mackey Chair in Creative Writing. He's leading a storytelling event on Sunday at Beloit College's Eaton Chapel. Here he is starting off a story in a recent Moth event.
When I was 15 years old, I lived for a while in a mausoleum. Actually, a very short while, less than a week. But it was actually a wonderful time. It was summer, and there were honeysuckle and fireflies.
And you can hear the rest of that story on The Moth's website. George Dawes Green joins us now from Beloit College. He's a poet, novelist, and founder of The Moth. George, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's nice to be here.
Well, George, can you tell us a little bit how you first came up with this idea for The Moth?
Well, I was in New York, and I had a successful novel, and I used to go to all these cocktail parties in New York, and, you know, people could never talk for more than about 15 seconds before the conversation vultures would interrupt. And so, you know, all you could do is get out quick one-liners at these parties. And I remembered having grown up in Georgia on a little island off the coast of Georgia, St. Simons. I just remembered the ability to tell stories. I used to go over to my friend Wanda's porch, and we'd sit there and just drink bourbon all night and tell stories. And I wanted something like that in New York City. I figured, you know, New York City was filled with great raconteurs. They just weren't being, you know, they weren't given a chance to tell their whole stories before they were interrupted. So I started The Moth, and the first Moth was terrible. It was just, it just felt like a disaster to me. And I'd spent all this time organizing, you know, and bringing all of my friends to my loft. And then up come these stories that all have, you know, morals, and they're all go on forever. And it just felt like nobody knew how to tell stories. But then we got really serious. We said, no, I think we can do this. And then we started to find great storytellers. Yes.
I'm sorry I'm interrupting your story, George, but how did you structure things to have successful storytelling?
Well, I mean, the first thing was just to find out what the elements of a good story were, you know? Jonathan Ames, who later had an HBO TV show called Bored to Death, and, you know, I think he has a TV show right now, but those came from Moth stories, but he came in very soon and just started to tell incredibly vulnerable stories about his bizarre sexual fantasies at age 13. And you felt like here was somebody who was perfectly willing to, you know, expose who he really was. And so, you know, he had this riveting story. And then we started to find some of the great raconteurs of New York, George Plimpton, and Frank McCourt, who wrote Angela's Ashes. And just, and so we began to find a structure, and right away people just fell in love with this idea of, you know, being in an audience where people were telling stories that were coming right out of their brains. They weren't, you know, memorized stories. There was no script, and they were telling these true personal stories, and people, you know, the response was electric, and we've grown since then.
We're talking with George Dawes Green right now. He's the founder of The Moth. And it sounds like early on you did hit on this realization that vulnerability was what made the story really pop, and not some story about how you were fine, but everything else was messed up.
Right, exactly. I mean, we always, you know, I found very quickly that we'd start getting celebrities to come tell us stories at The Moth. And the celebrities tended to tell stories in which they had found themselves in some horrible situation where they were surrounded by clowns and jokers, but they were able, you know, to bull their way through and survive. And meanwhile, we found that great raconteurs would tell the opposite story, in which they were in some situation where everybody was doing the best they could, and they were being the clown and the joker, and somehow the community survived. And that, you know, became so important to us to realize that great raconteurs almost always reveal their own clownishness. You know, they don't tell stories of success. That's for Hollywood pictures, but for the kind of stories that you want to hear from people, you just want to hear how people fail and screw up and then, you know, pull themselves together.
How do you make a safe place for somebody to be willing to be that vulnerable and off the cuff and unscripted in front of a bunch of people, maybe a bunch of strangers?
This is so interesting because this is really what the growth of the Moth has been all about, is that the audiences create that safe space, and it's reinforced through time. You know, when we first started our Moth slams, our amateur slams back in 2000, it's just, those are nights where people come and put their name in a hat, and you know, your name is picked, and then, you know, you get a score and you can win the slam and then go on to the Grand Slam, and you can become famous through this process. But originally it was only men who would do it. Women would not tell stories, you know, and we did everything we could, and we could get one woman a night who would invariably tell kind of a soft, gentle story and would lose. And so this happened for several years, and we just, you know, some people were saying, well, maybe, you know, men are just better storytellers than women. And then slowly women began to get up and tell stories, and other women sort of saw, oh, I can do that too. And now we've had, just in the last 15 years, this incredible transformation. The majority of our storytellers are now women. And they win the majority of the slams and the grand slams. And, you know, so we've created these great female raconteurs. But that wasn't something that anybody felt that they could do in the beginning. It just took, you know, it just took these nights. And it took women kind of seeing that there was a template.
Well, and for people who are hearing you talk and are inspired to do this, maybe a woman who wants to tell more stories in her life, maybe not just on stage, but anywhere, what kind of encouragement can you give us, or words of advice?
Well, I mean, first of all, there is that basic rule that a good story reveals a vulnerability. A good story isn't about your success. It's about, you know, your failure as a human being. But you know how you are, just simply human. And then a good story is always about a moment of decision. You know, people sometimes will come up and they'll think that they've got a good story because they tell about some horrible auto wreck that they went through, and, you know, all the hospital adventures. And usually those stories are incredibly dull, even though you'd think that, oh my gosh, this was, you know, this was such a terrible thing that they went through. But it's not really about a decision that you made. And those are the stories that everybody wants to hear. You know, even if they're just the tiniest decisions, if they're told, you know, where we can feel ourselves making that decision, then the story will become powerful.
This little storytelling event in a loft in New York has gotten pretty big. It's gone across the country. We're airing it here in Wisconsin. What is it about storytelling, telling stories and hearing stories, that has such an appeal to people?
Well, I mean, it is this, you know, it is in our DNA, isn't it? I mean, we really, you know, when we, I think humankind, we are the storytelling animal. Other primates don't have this kind of episodic memory, and we do, and we realize that it's a very powerful way to convey, you know, clusters of information that need to be conveyed. And so we, you know, if you think about the average person in, you know, in America, listens to stories probably more than anything else they do during the day. You know, they'll watch TV, they'll get online, they'll look at, you know, Trump. When people talk about Trump, they're really talking about a story. They don't really care so much about the policies. They really care about the story. So the idea of people just getting together in an actual physical space and sharing stories is so powerful. There's a communication between the storyteller and the audience that's unlike any kind of art form. And that's why, as you say, it's boomed. I mean, we're on, 600 radio stations now around the world. There are moths or moth clones in every major capital of the globe now. And all of this has happened, in the last 20 years.
Well, George, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about storytelling today.
Well, I hope that you all will come. If there's anybody who wants to come to this show in Beloit that we're doing at Sunday at 7 o'clock, there are still a handful of tickets, I am told. You can't buy them online anymore, but can I give this number?
Go for it, sure.
Yeah, it's Corey. You call Corey at 608-363-2625, and I understand there's just a handful of tickets.
Hopefully
left.
That's not her personal home phone.
No, it's not. And thank you guys.
That was George Dawes, Green, founder of The Moth. He's leading a storytelling event, as you heard, in Beloit College Sunday at 7. And you can also hear The Moth Radio Hour tonight at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network.
And you can hear the rest of that story. We started earlier. We've got a link to it at the Central Time Facebook page and some event info for Sunday.
The recent meeting of the UW Systems Board of Regents made news last week when President Ray Cross decided not to go forward with plans to have chancellors give short presentations on the impact of the recent $250 million budget cuts to their campuses.
Democratic lawmakers criticized the move, but reporting from the Wisconsin State Journal says President Ray Cross decided the presentations could have become a two-hour drumbeat of repetitive negative news.
This week, the Wisconsin State Journal obtained copies of those canceled presentations, and Higher Education reporter Nico Savage reported on the findings, and he joins us now. Nico, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So was there any reluctance from UW system chancellors to pass along these presentations about the effects of budget cuts?
Once we got kind of past the Board of Regents meeting, what UW system officials said was that they were taking, kind of pulling together each of these campus-produced documents summarizing how the budget cuts have been carried out, and they were giving them to the Board of Regents, and they were also going to be making them publicly available. So on Monday afternoon, in response to some criticism from legislators, from Democratic legislators, who say the cuts should have gotten a more public hearing, the board's president, Regina Milner, sent them a letter and included within that a link to where we could find all of these all of these documents, essentially summarizing where the rubbers hit the road with these budget cuts and how different UW campuses have been carrying them out.
So looking system-wide, big picture now, what did you see about the most common ways that UW campuses are dealing with these cuts?
Well, just about everybody's been cutting jobs. Each of the UW system's 14 four-year colleges, it's four-year universities, it's two-year colleges, it's extension programs. They've been cutting jobs through buyouts, through layoffs, through contracts that they weren't extending. They've also been closing several vacant positions. UW-Eau Claire, for instance, cut about 15% of its workforce. So we're seeing a lot of these universities shedding jobs, usually staff jobs, administration jobs, that sort of thing. We're seeing a lot of campuses go that route. We're also one result of them shedding jobs, and another strategy that we've seen is a reduction in the number of course offerings and cuts to the number of class sections. More than half of UW's 40 universities wrote in their budget presentations that they were going to do that, predicting it would increase class sizes and also potentially making it take longer for students to be able to get a time to degree, because if there's only so many spots in a given class and you're not able to get that one, you might have to wait another semester. And we've seen a few others, like I mentioned, cuts to administration, cutting resources for advising, which also has an impact on students. But generally, those were some of the big core areas where we're seeing the universities make cuts.
Did you get a sense of which particular campuses seem to be the most affected?
I think the ones that are kind of hardest hit, and this is what we've been hearing from UW officials and higher ed experts essentially since these budget cuts were announced, were always going to be the ones that did not have the ability to kind of raise extra money, campuses that were seeing their enrollment decline. So I mentioned UW-Eau Claire. The impact of the budget cut was sort of magnified by the fact that they also, on top of losing $7.7 million in state funding, lost another $1.5 million as a result of declining enrollment. So smaller schools, those programs that don't have, for instance, like UW-Madison, a base of wealthy alumni who, you know, not to say that there's not pain happening on those campuses, but they certainly have more ways to deal with them, to deal with those cuts than, say, a smaller campus that's, you know, entirely used up its budgetary reserve and you know, is not able to say, charge more for out-of-state tuition as UW-Madison has.
And were there any of those smaller campuses that had completely used up those reserve funds?
I feel like I keep harping on UW-Eau Claire, but they are one that mentioned it. It's sort of hard to know. These summaries were essentially documents prepared by, you know, 13 different organizations. So you're basically looking at, or 14, I should say, with UW colleges and extension. So you're kind of looking at 14 different takes on this. It's a little hard to get a direct comparison, but several do mention that they've either spent down their reserves to what they consider you know, unsustainable levels. UW-Madison, for instance, has only got about a week's worth of operating money within its reserve account. Or like UW-Eau Claire, they said that they've spent it entirely down to zero, and they call that a big kind of threat to the university's financial stability.
We're talking with Nico Savage right now. He covers higher education at the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about how UW system campuses are dealing with recent budget cuts. And the reserve funds... that has been in the news. We talked about that a bit. What about retaining faculty and how that plays into this financial picture?
Sure. Several universities mentioned that they have lost faculty. One thing that they attribute that to is their inability to pay them as competitively as they would like, pay them as well as they would like. They say that their faculty members are able to make more money if they go to other universities in other states or to private universities. I know at UW-Madison, there's been the complaint from administrators that essentially the cuts and also changes to tenure that have made some that several people say have made faculty more inclined to leave the university has resulted in the university having to spend more in order to retain those faculty. Chancellor Rebecca Blank saying at a Board of Regents meeting a few months ago that the university had spent about $8 million on retention efforts just in the first few months of the academic year. So it's certainly having an impact on that. If you talk to UW officials, that's what they'll tell you.
Now that these presentations have been released, is it still a contentious political matter about how this information should be used?
It would appear as though it is. I mean, we've seen Democratic legislators call in over the past week or so for public hearings in the legislative committees on higher education, and the Republican leaders of those committees. I know the Assembly's leader has basically said no, that we're not going to do that. Haven't heard a response from the Senate's leader. There's certainly, I think, Democrats would like much more attention to be drawn to this. They say that's because, you know, they want voters to, or they want voters and also local stakeholders and local politicians to know that essentially this is what happens when you cut your university system. On the other hand, you asked Governor Scott Walker's office about his response to the cuts, and his spokeswoman sent back a statement pointing out that the overall budget for the University of Wisconsin system was actually up slightly this year over the year prior. UW system officials say that's because they've been spending down those reserve funds, and basically the governor's spokesperson saying, quote, the UW should be able to fund its priorities given that. So certainly a lot of kind of disagreement over the significance of what's kind of detailed in these documents.
And looking at arguments that could be made from these presentations, did you see an overarching theme? You talked a little about this, but was there a strong presence of, look, these cuts are ultimately going to hurt students and maybe going to hurt retention and push back graduation rates?
I think that was certainly part of it. UW system officials specifically said that they wanted these presentations to be very factual and to be focusing on the impact on students and local economies. And you certainly saw that at work. We mentioned the, you know, issue with time to degree and advising resources that are available to students. We also saw that in several presentations, including UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee, which mentioned that they have not been able to add to growing programs like engineering and nursing and business, kind of add resources to expand those, which you could argue is affecting local economies if you're not able to get people through those programs. So certainly a desire to show on the part of UW officials kind of where this is playing out for students and businesses off campus.
And UW Regents President Regina Miller said that the way these presentations were going to be used about the effect of the budget cuts, the more effective way she thought was to take it to the people. Do you have a sense about what that means and who might be approached with these?
Right. So President Milner said at the board's meeting last week in UW Green Bay that essentially, if you really want to go through the impact, if you're a chancellor and you want to talk about the impact the budget cuts are having on your university, you need more than 5 minutes standing in front of the Board of Regents. What she says is that chancellors should be kind of engaging people at the more local level, talking with their local residents, with local business groups, local chambers of commerce, representatives in the legislature, talking with them about those impacts on kind of an in-person and kind of meeting people where they are was the phrase that she used in order to describe how this is playing out.
Nico, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Nico Savage covers higher education at the Wisconsin Journal Sentinel, and he joined us there to talk about how the UW system is dealing with budget cuts. Democratic presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders will meet again this evening on the debate stage. It's been more than a month since the two last debated, and the campaign has gotten more contentious since that time.
In the run-up to next week's crucial primary election in New York, both candidates have been taking shots at each other. Sanders has publicly questioned Clinton's judgment and credibility, at one point told a crowd of supporters she's not qualified to be president. Meanwhile, Clinton criticized Sanders for promoting a platform she calls unrealistic. So what should we expect tonight when the two face off?
Matthew Dickinson joins us now. He's a professor of political science at Middlebury College. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be on with you.
So tonight, Clinton and Sanders will be meeting in New York just days before the state's primary. How important is New York to both candidates at this point?
It's hard to overstate the significance at this point, particularly the Sanders campaign. He's running out of real estate. He needs to gather delegates in big bunches if he's going to try to make a plausible case that even if he can't win the nomination outright with pledged delegates, he's at least competitive enough to start swinging some of those superdelegates over to him. And there's just not a lot of opportunity left for him to make that case, so this is really crucial for him. But it's also crucial for Hillary because she's trying to put him away and trying to pivot to this general election, and he's like a bad habit. She just can't get rid of him. And so if she can have a convincing win in her home state with 247 delegates at stake, this will go a long way to finally turning the narrative here towards the general election.
Right. So if Hillary Clinton wins, as at this point she's projected to do, is it essentially the end of the game for Bernie Sanders?
Well, it's not going to be the end of the game for a couple of reasons. One is, on the Democratic side, this is a proportional primary. So let's assume he gets roughly 40% of the vote. He is going to take home a chunk of the delegates. Now, it's not going to be nearly enough to change the narrative, but it will be enough to keep the sense that he has won a degree of support within his own party that justifies going on, that his message is resonating with at least enough voters that he might as well stay out there and continue to try to make his case. So I don't think this is going to be conclusive, even if Hillary wins by the margins projected in the polls.
You've been talking about using the word narrative here, and he does have a bit of a narrative going right now in that he's been saying, look, I have momentum right now. I've won something like the last six of seven. Is that a narrative that is picking up traction, and what happens if he does have a good showing in New York?
Well, it is a narrative that's picking up traction. Most of the major media sources are using that term, and there's a superficial appeal to it. I mean, if the guy wins seven out of the last eight contests, as he has, that seems to be the very definition of momentum. The reality is, if you look at the contests he's won, they are tailor-made for him. Most of them were caucus states. Most of them had, therefore, smaller turnout. Most were largely white and had a significant liberal population. And if you run a simple statistical analysis of predictors of his support, it's running a caucus as opposed to a primary and running in a state that's largely white. He's running out of those states. There's only two more caucus states. New York is has a strong non-white population. So I expect the momentum narrative is not going to go very well in New York because it's a misleading barometer of why he's winning. It's demographics much more than momentum that's explained his recent success, and those demographics are changing dramatically next Tuesday.
And this is going to be an interesting night as a touch point in the campaign, because if you look back at some of those early Democratic debates, the two candidates treated each other, not deferentially, but very gently. They didn't go after each other head on. And I think it's fair to say in the last week or so that the rhetoric between them has sharpened noticeably. Clinton has seemed irritable. Sanders has been more on the attack and in terms of his rhetoric, more directed toward her now, to the point where some in the Clinton camp have said, oh, this is a character attack. And it's been going back and forth. So do you expect to see a change in tone tonight?
I do. I mean, the road to the nomination is paved with good intentions, but the reality is, in part, they've fleshed out their differences on policy so much, and it just hasn't done enough, particularly from Sanders' perspective, to gain traction. So he has to look elsewhere. And, you know, they've been at it for a long time. Both sides are getting a little irritated with each other, and things slip that maybe they wouldn't have said earlier in the campaign, but they're looking for an edge here. And particularly on Sanders' side, he's got to try something to differentiate himself. And if policy's not going to work, then you turn to character. You try to make an issue of Clinton's judgment, of her temperament, of being in hock to Wall Street, anything that might buy you some additional support among the dwindling number of undecided voters. So I'm really not surprised that given the stakes and given the dwindling time left for both candidates to make their case, they've become a little edgier in how they're treating each other. And I expect to see a lot more of that tonight.
We're talking right now with Matt Dickinson, professor of political science at Middlebury College. And Matt, some political watchers have also pointed out that the candidates may be sort of leaving breadcrumbs for the media, hoping that they get picked up tonight in the debate. Bernie Sanders, for instance, just released this ad about fracking.
Do Washington politicians side with polluters over families? They sure do, because big oil pumps millions into their campaigns. Bernie Sanders is the only candidate for president who opposes fracking everywhere.
Is an ad like that sort of designed to perk up the moderator? In this case, I guess it's Wolf Blitzer, so that Bernie Sanders gets to sort of define some of the questions that might come up tonight?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, both sides are going to try to game this by planting the seeds, as you point out quite correctly, in the moderator's eyes and mind about certain issues that should be raised. And, of course, you know, from CNN's perspective, the idea here is to put the candidates on edge, try to, you know, not incidentally boost some ratings by generating some controversy. And both candidates are only too glad to help out by, as you say, planting the, sort of the seeds here.
And in the past week, it's, you know, things have been tougher for both candidates, and Bernie Sanders had some moments interviewed by major papers in New York saying, some saying he was not as clear as he could have been on foreign policy.
Right.
Is he going to be pressed on that tonight? Do you think maybe to be more specific?
Well, he will be pressed on this. The problem he has on attacking Hillary on foreign policy is he has become late to the game in developing a detailed foreign policy portfolio, and he's really not as knowledgeable on foreign policy. His candidacy is based on domestic policy. On the other hand, if he wants to make the case against Hillary, he's going to do so in part on her judgment on major foreign policy issues, you know, her original vote to attack to allow the president to attack Iraq, and more recently, you know, Libya, which President Obama has admitted has been a big mistake of his administration. So Sanders is caught in a little bit of a conundrum here. He sees an opening to attack her on foreign policy, but if he does so, he also leaves himself vulnerable to her counterattacking and demonstrating that she just has much more depth on this foreign policy issue. So it's a delicate dance for him, but I don't see much alternative. He's got to score some points and score big.
Do you think it's a good thing for Democrats overall that maybe the debate tonight will be a little sharper, a little more heated? Because until now, the Republican narrative has been the stronger one, the more interesting one for the media to follow. You've had the Donald Trump narrative and the establishment wringing its hands over what's going to happen. And the Democrats over there are not, in lots of cases, getting the same kind of coverage because the story just hasn't been as compelling.
Well, one indicator of that is turnout. Turnout is down from the last time the Democrats had a contested primary in 2008. Of course, that was an extraordinary year. But still, turnout is up among the Republicans. So you're absolutely right. The Republican race is because of the Donald, is generating much more interest, much more media coverage. But there's a downside. You know, with controversy comes the risk that your candidate's unfavorable ratings are going to go up. Now, Hillary Clinton, historically speaking, has very high unfavorable ratings among the general population. And the degree that Bernie Sanders continues to lob grenades at her, she's not going to come out of this unscathed. So for Democrats, the risk here is, yes, you generate media coverage and you sharpen the debate so that the distinctions can be brought out, but you may also begin to hurt your candidate looking ahead to the general election. And this is what the Clinton people in particular are worried about. They don't want to be dragged through the mud to such a degree that they're still cleaning themselves off when they have to face the Republican coming after Labor Day.
Now, one other issue that may come up tonight, speaking of dragging through the mud, I guess, or not, Hillary Clinton has released her federal tax returns from the past several years. Bernie Sanders has not. His wife does his taxes, apparently, and she said he will release this year's. What can we expect about that?
Well, it'll come up. I mean, you know, the Clintons, this is not going to be a surprise to them. They made a lot of money on speaking. And, of course, this is already a point of attack that Sanders is going to use, and he's going to raise this again about her Wall Street connections, Goldman Sachs, how much money she got. At this point, all she can do is parry and return fire. She can't hide this. You can't say, hey, I'm actually a poor. You know, everybody knows she's earned these big speaking fees. And so you just take the incoming from the Sanders campaign and you try to move the conversation forward.
We're talking right now with political science professor Matt Dickinson, talking about the state of the Democratic race. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are taking the debate stage tonight.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. In the Democratic race for president, which candidate are you pulling for? What issues are most important to you? Are you hearing Sanders and Clinton adequately address them? If you're still undecided, could anything be said, say in tonight's debate, that would win you over? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now about the state of the Democratic presidential race as Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders get set to debate once again this evening. Our guest is Matt Dickinson. He's a professor of political science at Middlebury College.
And you can join in with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the contest between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton so far? What are you expecting from tonight's debate? What do you want to see? And if you're a Democrat, who got your vote in Wisconsin's primary and why? You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And, you know, one of the big narratives, again, Matt, for the Republicans has been this sort of split between the establishment and the leading candidates, Donald Trump in this point. Establishment also reported not to be super supportive of Ted Cruz either. Do you see something like that happening with the Democrats?
Well, there's a risk. I have students who are really intricately involved in the Sanders campaign. In fact, one of them started the College Students for Bernie chapters that have sprung up all over. And she tells me that the internal discussions among the students, who are a big part of his support, when you go to his rallies, you see tons of students here. And many of them are just resisting the idea that if he loses the nomination, that they're going to go out there and work on behalf of Hillary Clinton. And this is something the party has to worry about. They have to worry about healing the wounds after a very bitter, divisive primary, one that's becoming increasingly so, and probably will continue in that trend as we move closer to the end of the contests. But the reality is, once you get past this fight and your candidate has been selected, you then begin to reorient yourself, and despite the promises that I would never vote for that other candidate because she's the Antichrist, the reality is the Antichrist now becomes the person in the other party, Donald Trump, for instance. And it's going to be very difficult for Sanders people, no matter how much they dislike the idea of supporting Clinton, to actually say, I'm not going to vote and risk putting Donald Trump in the driver's seat for the general election. So I think time will heal most wounds, if not all wounds, within the Democratic Party. But Hillary is going to have to allow Sanders to make his claim to represent a certain important faction in the party. That's probably going to mean prime speaking position at the convention if things go the way they're going now, and perhaps even more, some concessions on policy and appointments. So there's some healing ahead of us. We're not there yet, and I don't want to jump the gun, but it's a significant concern for the party.
Let's go to our callers now. We have Alexandra on the line with us in Madison. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi. I have two comments. One, I voted for Sanders, and there are lots of reasons why I would vote for Sanders. I think that it's important to remember that there are a lot of independents in this race, and they're not going to be voting in the New York primary, but they count for a lot of the votes. And I think a lot of younger people may turn to being independents instead of continuing a respect for the DNC if they realize that this party doesn't represent them and if they don't want to follow a politics of fear. I also really hope that tonight in the debate they bring up climate change. I really want to see whether Hillary can have a stance that is not just pro-industry but actually mentions things like the carbon tax, which Sanders has talked about.
Great. Thanks so much, Alexandra. Some good points there. And she's talking about independence, maybe not necessarily, you know, pledging fealty to the DNC. Does that mean that the GOP, maybe Donald Trump, if he's the nominee, would get some of those votes, do you think, Matt?
Well, he is attracting support among independents, the same that Clinton is, Sanders. Both of them are positioning themselves as anti-establishment candidates, and as such, they're drawing a little bit on those independents, but different types of independents. Sanders is drawing much more on sort of the progressive, the Ralph Nader type independents. Trump is drawing much more on people who are typically do not participate in politics, lower income, lower educated, predominantly white voters, who are now being drawn into the political process because of him. But the caller makes a couple of interesting observations that I talked about earlier. One is, you know, that tone that you hear among students in particular, that they'd rather vote for a third-party candidate as opposed to supporting Hillary Clinton, and they're threatening to bolt the party. You really have to take those statements in the context of being in the heat of a campaign, and I suspect most students will come back to the fold and support Hillary. Now, the fracking issue, that's one that's going to come up, fracking and climate change, and of course we all know the infamous exchange between Clinton on the receiving line and one of the environmental activists who basically asked her whether she's going to stop accepting money from the oil and gas lobby, and she reacted quite vehemently, saying she's not getting direct contributions. You know, that is a point of contention between them. Bill McKibben's group, 350, has come out and endorsed Sanders. He has strong support among students, and that's a clear dividing line. I expect she's going to have an answer to that, but it's not going to appease all environmentalists.
Thanks for that, Kali Alexandra. And we're going to go next to Luke in Cross Plains. Luke, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My answer is in response to the question you asked about what we wanted to see kind of with the debate tonight. I wanted to see two major things. One, Bernie Sanders focusing more on how his policies benefit minorities. I think he's avoided doing that because he doesn't want to alienate anybody, particularly, you know, his white voters and middle-class voters. But I think that may have hurt him in the long run with the black community and Latino voters. And on top of that, I also want to hear some questions from the moderators towards Hillary Clinton on some of her foreign policy choices that she's made, such as choices to, like, back the military coup in Honduras when there was, and, you know, recently there's been an assassination of one of the leaders there, and, you know, they were wanting to get back towards the democracy, but somehow Clinton has deluded herself into thinking that her choice to keep the military in is better for democracy. I don't know.
Luke, thanks a lot for those points, and let's get you in on this, Matthew. Do you think that these are issues that are going to come up? Will Bernie Sanders talk about his policies and how they affect people of color in the country? And talking about Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State, is that going to be a strength, do you think, or a liability at this point?
Well, let's take the first issue first, the African-American community. Sanders is already conducting outreach in New York City. He realizes that he's got to broaden his appeal. This is not a typical, as I talked about earlier, state that he's been winning, even the primary in Wisconsin that he won. Wisconsin, larger white population proportionally than in New York. He has a problem, though. He has not been able to convince the non-white community that he understands their interests, even though he is has roots dating back to the civil rights movement. Those concerned a different set of issues. The young blacks, in particular, are concerned about institutional racism, you know, treatment by police, and so on. And the fact of the matter is, Bernie comes from a state, a predominantly white state, Vermont. He hasn't had to deal with these issues. He doesn't speak the language, and despite making overtures, he just hasn't caught on among the black community, particularly older African-Americans who are solidly in Hillary's corner.
And Matt, just briefly about foreign policy as we get a little short of time.
Okay. Foreign policy is, you know, that regime change issue is going to come up. That's going to be a strong point for Sanders tonight. He's going to push Hillary on judgment. He's going to try to tar her with some of these foreign policy outcomes that have been less than desirable. We talked earlier about Libya, and certainly that'll be a point of contention.
And so you think tonight's stakes are high?
Hard to say how they can be any higher. I mean, this is the biggest delegate haul in a while. Both sides have a stake, a claim that this is their home state. It's really going to be definitive, I think, in either changing the narrative towards Sanders' favor or basically making the case that this is all but over and Clinton is well on her way to the nomination.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
My pleasure.
Matt Dickinson is a professor of political science at Middlebury College, and he joined us to preview tonight's Democratic debate in New York between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.